New year, Top Gear, race here.
Gentlemen, start your engines.
Hello and welcome back to our special episode of the Motor Racing Passion Podcast, where we're celebrating the Race of a Thousand Years, an international sports car race that took place on the streets of Adelaide using the Formula One Grand Prix circuit on New Year's Eve in the year 2000. If you haven't listened to part one, we discussed the lead up to the event, and in this part we are taking a dive into the race itself and the aftermath. Joining me, Luke Blattman again, and my brothers Daniel and Adam, and my friend Brock Schaefer. So the big story in the first 2 days of on-track action leading into the race was Alan McNish's back. How did he hurt it?
Apparently, which story do you want?
Yeah, he was dancing in a kilt or something.
He was hopping out of his kilt.
Hopping in, hopping out, dancing around in his kilt and got injured. That's what I heard.
Yeah, he was lifting some suitcases as well.
In a kilt, possibly.
Potentially, yeah. And then was the other one crashing a bike or...
Fell off his push bike.
Yeah.
Maybe it was... lifting his luggage while riding a bike in his kilt, then he had to step out of his kilt when he crashed it.
Maybe it was a bit of all.
Yeah, the fact that there's that many stories going around, it's a bit like the Montoya and his shoulder one playing tennis. So yeah, it's probably right. On the bike.
Well, there we go. He was riding a bike in a kilt with a suitcase, and that's how he injured it.
Yeah. But I mean, he was basically it was between him and Dindo Capello to win the championship. They were in the same car, and McNish had only got ahead due to the interesting ALMS point score.
Yeah, so he only had to do 25 laps in the race, is that correct?
Because they were driving together.
Yes.
One driver could get a bonus point, depending who set the fastest lap.
I find it interesting that you have to have a lap requirement in a timed race.
Yeah, that still happens to this day.
That's interesting, though, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, not a minimum hour.
You think it'd be time, you know, like a percentage, because then it's a guaranteed percentage of the race.
Mm. Yep.
Whereas if it's laps, like if it's wet or your car is like super slow or something. Yeah. Interesting.
So in practice and qualifying, it becomes pretty clear that the Audi is the quickest car.
And On form for the year.
Right. It's not just the quickest car. It's like a dominated 2020 Mercedes on steroids.
So really, I guess the McNish in his back was sort of a bit of drama thrown in to the front runners.
Not the only drama the front runners would have in the lead up to the race either.
No. Amongst others, they call in Brad Jones to potentially replace him.
That's a big scoop for Brad Jones, fronting the Audi program in Australia.
He got lined up in some pretty cool rides.
Yeah.
Really, like all the Audis and everything.
Yeah, shows you having a good relationship with a manufacturer can pay off.
That's very cool.
Just getting the call up and, to drive one of those cars, jumping from what was in at the time.
Aussie Mal Falcon.
And just finished up with the Audi. So you go from a front-wheel drive 2-litre car and to a whole rear-wheel drive Holden Commodore into a panel sports car.
Yeah. AU Falcon.
Yeah, sorry.
Some say the best model, not me.
Definitely an icon.
But so while that's going on, the Australian driver Jim Cornish, who was driving the pill beam, that car gets withdrawn due to homologation problems.
Which is strange, because I get that it apparently had FIA homologation approval, but not ACO'd. Why not just run the thing?
That wasn't even an outright car.
No. And it's still, but it got bumped into the outright car.
What was wrong with its homologation?
It was to do with the pedal box. It was... one story was that it was homologated with the FIA, but the ACO didn't recognise it, or the Le Mans rules didn't recognise that homologation. The other one was that it had passed its homologation, but the team didn't have the papers to prove it. So
why not just run it and then they DQ it? You've come all the way to Australia. Just run the thing around
There was a quote from the team saying that even though they weren't running, they'd rather be here not running than back at home. So
really?
Yeah. So I guess they still have to spend New Year's Eve.
Well, I guess it's a free holiday.
Yeah.
See, maybe they knew it wasn't going to get allowed to race. And they were like, Don's putting on this free holiday for everyone. He pays to ship the car out. Let's do it.
Yeah. Also becomes clear in the early days that Penoz's, Don Penoz is just very delighted with the facilities. And he says that the series has a long future in Australia. Rather ominously again, as we were
jinxed
saying.
It.
But also the David Brabham says that the Penoz just is struggling for pace compared to the Audis.
So there were two iterations of Penoz in that event.
Yes, yep.
And Murphy and Bright were in the older version.
With David Brabham, yep.
Yeah.
And Jan Magnussen was in the new one.
Yeah, okay.
They were a fair way off the pace on the opening days, weren't they?
Have you seen the new one was? The 2000 spec one was pretty good.
Have you seen the onboard with the 2000 one? Because they ride on board with the Audi and it's so smooth. It's like this seagull just gliding over the ocean. And then they jump on board with Brabham and it's like a freaking pogo stick. Yeah, like it just looks undrivable.
Ultimately, it pretty much goes to plan. The Audis lock out the front row in qualifying. And in the GTS class, the Vipers are very dominant in that.
Oh, they were a cool car, weren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. They looked good too. They did. That red colour scheme with the white stripes up the middle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it wasn't a fiercely contested qualifying session, but for a 6-hour, I suppose no one was looking to, try and steal the pole position away from Audi.
No.
Never in question.
So then we come to race morning and Dindo crashes the Audi.
And
in the morning warm-up.
How often in big events do you see that happen these days?
Yeah. Wasn't it a suspension failure?
Wheel fell off.
Yeah. It was a car failure, yeah. And you know what it was interesting as well that I found out is they recovered like almost no parts from the car. So everything just has gone
disappeared. So it's in man cave somewhere in South Australia.
I think the Martian just scooped it up, launched it into the crowd, and it was just there.
Yeah. But of all the things that could go wrong.
So they skinned a crocodile in Adelaide.
Yeah. Pretty much.
It reminds you of the diamonds on the Jaguar nose cone.
Oh, that's
at Monaco and they crashed and the diamonds just vanished. Yeah. Hmm.
Ended up on the casino at Monte Carlo.
Yeah, mate.
So they were worried they may not be able to fix the car, but it ended up the monocoque wasn't damaged, so they were able to repair it, and then Alan McNish was able to take the start because they'd worked on his back throughout all Saturday.
Because he didn't drive it all on Saturday.
Not on Saturday, no. And he'd only done a few laps on Friday.
And Brad Jones drove it on Saturday.
Saturday, and he did a bit of the warm-up as well.
Okay. Yeah, he got to, I think his best lap was about 6 seconds off, which is pretty respectable for being thrown in at last.
Because he would have had to do minimum laps to be included into the event.
That's probably all
event.
It was, just to just roll around and...
Don't bin it.
Yeah.
We'll come to that in a bit, Brad Jones driving, but... At the start, it's an all-Audi front row, and Frank Bieler initially takes the lead, and the two Audis just take off. David Brabham gives a bit of chase early, but...
It was kind of just a rolled off the start and just got into line in the first half of the first half of the opening lap.
Yeah, McNish just pulls in a line behind Bieler, I think it was, who opened it, and which is a smart move, feeling out his back.
Yeah.
So
Brabham gives chase, but he just slowly loses a bit every lap. And as it goes on, McNish starts getting right up onto the back of Frank Bieler.
It's an interesting battle that, because he McNish is all over the back of him. The seagull kind of motion that you were saying how the Audi was gliding apart changed a bit when McNish is bouncing from side to side. He's stepping the thing out. But ironically, when he puts the move on Bieler kind of just coming out of the hairpin into that double left, he just kind of opens the door around some back marks.
It's like he gets out of his way.
Yeah, that looks sus.
Reminds me of a saying, the 1981 Formula One World Championship finale, that when Nelson Piquet comes up behind title rival Carlos Reutemann and he just pulls up behind him, outbrakes him, passes him. Nelson Piquet was quoted after the race. He said that I came up behind Reutemann and he opened his legs. I mean, that's pretty much what Beeler did. He just came out of the airpin, pulled right, and like, McNish just went underneath him.
Do you think it may have been him? He would have obviously known McNish had back issues and he had to do his 25 laps. Do you think Beeler was like, I'll let him go. He's probably going to, you know, come towards the end of the 25 laps. Something might happen to his back. I'll just let him go. He's going to hop out of the car. Then the other driver has to do the majority of the other.
I think he just had that much pace.
Yeah. I think if anything, Beeler was probably like, he's all over me.
What's the point?
I mean, McNish probably wasn't going to try and have a deep dive at him. But Beeler was probably like, he's annoying me being behind there.
Yeah, it was in traffic. It was probably the most interesting sequence of the race. Mm.
Well, yeah, because McNish takes the lead and he just takes off.
Mm. Yeah. End of the second lap, the brand new panels.
Yeah.
Enters the pits and never to be seen again.
Yeah.
Ominous. Sir, thank you for that car, because that sums it up, really.
Yeah, and I mean, by the 2 hour mark of the race, McNish is leading Beeler by nearly 1.5 minutes.
Yeah.
That's two pit stops in. Although Beeler had lost time, he ran into Bob Wallach's Porsche, which spun the Porsche right around, and Beeler lost a bit of time. Brabham he nearly had a crash with Boris Said coming into I was supposed to be
down Wakefield Street.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, he squeezed him some air over the wheel strip too.
I mean, it almost went nowadays. Someone did that, they'd pull into the pits and replace a nose, or then Brabham just turns around and gets going again.
No, that wasn't very kind of Boris.
Yep. Brad Jones, who we touched on earlier, he did have a bit of a participation during the opening part of the race when he was helping out in the Audi pit stops. So he'd belt the driver
assistant, yeah.
But, yeah, I mean,
Brabham was kind of hanging in there, but, yeah, as I said, like miles back, well over a minute back, but just kind of holding strong in third spot.
And the field starts falling apart behind them. Like, both the Dams Cadillacs are out.
This was common back in those days.
Yeah.
They were so disappointing, those Cadillacs. Hey, they looked mint. And they weren't particularly fast, but I was like, they were the two cars that you think you could have hung in there, and this was the type of event that was made for them with the high attrition.
Yeah.
But no, they were gone very early.
Yeah.
It almost seems that 3 hour mark halfway through the race, that's when talked about the Dams Cadillacs there, for it there, from it there, and the other panels with Kato when it snaps a drive shaft.
Yep.
For it there. So it all seemed to take off.
Was I correct? They pushed that number two panels back into the pits from the front straight.
Yeah, it happened on the front straight. Yeah.
Incredible.
What's wrong with that?
Well, I was like, shows you the time 20 years ago. But yeah, I was watching that again. Is this for real?
Well, also around half distance, that's when the second placed Emanuele Piero Audi crashes into the wall.
Yeah, Got squeezed by one of the.
Yeah, I mean, he was being quite forceful through the traffic. Like he's having a go, but he gets on the marbles in the. I mean, a few people have gone off in that spot over the years, but he hits the wall and he parks it twice trying to get it back to the pits. And
yeah.
And I mean, I don't think the car ends up getting back to the pits.
2 hours after he. So under its own speed, gets back to the pits 2 hours after the accident. Yeah. It's like, good on him. He stuck with it.
He pulls it over once on the Jones straight, then pulls it over again on the Brabham straight. And
from my access to endurance racing that I've been participating in for it, I would say that someone on a scooter probably jumped in, went round, casually dropped off some parts for him to get it rolling, to get back there, or there was a mechanic there telling him what to do, because I'm assuming, without knowing the rules off by heart, that they would have said there would be no team interaction outside of it, but the driver can do what he needs. So I dare say he would have, you know, worked on the car himself and get it back. Or it may have been overheating and it just took that much time for it to get back to cool down to get there.
No, the car was pretty secondhand, I think.
Good on them, though, for sticking with it. And watching that drive in back into the pits, that was awesome.
So that put the Brabham Murphy Bright Penos into second. They were two laps adrift at halfway in second place. And then not long after that, Murphy puts it into the wall.
Puts in the wall hard too. That's when I first saw it, I assumed it was like they were just wearing brakes, which you can understand around the track. But everything I've looked at, they've just said, no, he's just gone in, carried too much speed. And yeah, and you can see him try and steer out of it as you can see the wall approaching.
It was one of those, like, I know he hits a tyre wall, but the damage doesn't seem to equate to how big the crash was.
He tore that front left right off. So,
like you'd think he's just, it looks like, I mean, a heavy hit, but it's like he just nosed it in.
Yeah, and it's full of tires.
Back, yeah, yeah, and they're driving back. I mean, the wheel's hanging off. And
yeah. But no, but once again, credit to Panos for repairing the the car and getting it back in the race. Obviously, a large number of laps down.
Until the next one happens again. Different driver at the helm, though. Who was at the wheel for the second one for that?
That was Bridie.
Bridie. Yeah, he puts it in late in the race.
Once again, strange place, that right left, and just what the rear steps out, tries to catch it, and it fires him in.
Apparently it was really, I heard them saying on an interview or something somewhere that it was a really, really strange car to drive.
Yeah.
Like, just really unorthodox to drive.
Yeah. And especially, you think it's not when Bright was driving it. It's had the front end of it rebuilt as well. So, there's probably a lot going on.
Corner weights would have been a...
So, I mean, it ends up being a waltz, really, to the victory by... McNish does a great job, despite his back. He does quite a bit of the race. And the car never looked like losing, really.
No.
In his hands or Dindo's hands.
That controlled it from the front.
The team did debate putting Bray Jones in for the last 15 minutes of the race, but they couldn't get a clear indication of... So they won the race 21 laps ahead of second place, the France Conrad, Charlie Slater, Alan Heath, Lola.
Shout out, though, to both those Lolas, the Raffinelli, Olive Garden Lola, and then obviously the Conrad Motorsports one. But two cars that were a long way behind all those top prototypes. They're an odd-looking shape, that Lola. But, geez, yeah. I was cheering on that Raffinelli car.
I didn't like the nose of it.
Oh, no, it wasn't with that headlight in the middle. But yeah. 20 years ago, still to this day, I was watching it, especially the Raffinelli one.
Yeah.
Those onboard shots that the NBC broadcast showed. Looks an absolute treat. Yeah. So, yeah, I was heartbroken when that one broke out late in the race. Broke down when they were looking at a podium.
Yeah.
But, like, I guess we just talked about some of the attrition that was in the race, but you look at who popped up on the third place in the podium. You got Beretta, Wengliger, and Dupont in the Viper. That's not too bad for a GTS spec car.
Oh, very cool. Like, definitely worth a mention. That was one thing that stood out to me when I saw the results.
Yeah. They got third and fourth in the leading GT class Porsche, finished up fifth with Dirk Müller and Lucas Lehr, who went on to.
Took out the championship.
Yeah.
Actually, I believe all three cars that won that round also took the championship. So some nice alignment and synergy there.
Yeah. So ultimately, just I suppose it summed up the year, really.
Yeah. No, dominant cars. It's nice to see all three classes, the champions and the season with the win.
Yeah. So really, I mean, there were a few different crowd announcements announced over the course of the weekend. For the end of the race, but the general, it was around 80,000 turned out on race day, which I think is a really good crowd.
Oh, I think it's very impressive. But no one had sneezed at that today.
No.
Roughly 150, give or take, over the 3 days as well.
And if you watch the tape of the race, I mean, the stands are full. There's
It looks great. Yeah. Looked really good.
But, I mean, it wasn't a great race.
No.
But the like event...
It was good hype. Yeah. It was a good idea, but it was a crap race.
Bit of a fizzer, really.
Yeah, that's one for the purists, you might say there, Brock.
It was one you were more hoping. You would have sat there at the start line thinking, I hope Brabham can keep him in sight.
Mm.
But
it was one of those
hope Beeler and Pirro might have...
It was just cool to see those cars around that
track. Exactly. Yeah. That's where the...
But then you imagine if you threw BMW, if they made the trek out, where would they fit? With the Audi resurgence in the second half of the ALMS season in that.
Mm.
Yeah.
No, it would have been interesting because obviously they would have been closer to put a bit more pressure. Like they wouldn't have had the speed for the 77, but at least they would have been closer to put that pressure on.
Yeah.
Bit of scoreboard pressure.
So that's sort of a bit of a wrap up on the race, and we'll be back after the break to talk about, unfortunately, what happened next.
Waiting for another episode to drop? Tumdrum Media has you covered with a range of podcasts perfect for your daily commute. Why not check out The Curious Audience? Go in pursuit of the unknown with a Yowie hunter. Find out some dirty little secrets from a sex therapist. Or hear the explosive stories of a rock star performing in a battleground. Find The Curious Audience on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back to the podcast. So we've just gone over what happened in the race. After the event, there was a lot of positivity. A 2001 event was announced, not on New Year's Eve though, unfortunately. This was going to be a race on December 2, 2001, but optimism in general that the race was going to kick on.
Yeah, and I think from everything I'd seen at the time, and just, I was really excited to see where the event would go 12 months on. And as you said, that movement to December 2, I think looking at your BMW and your Corvette examples, just moving it back that month, still at the end of the season, but, you know, not on that fringe of the 2 years, I thought it was a positive move.
Yeah, I mean, especially as you had some new manufacturers talking about coming in at the time that may, and with the plan of an Asia-Pacific series, could have maybe got some of the Japanese manufacturers back interested in the series in like long term, looking forward.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, I mean, just a bit more of a foothold you were hoping in the Australian market, that with the number of Australian competitors, the Nations Cup Championship in Australia, just growing that little bit more. The avenue for more crossover from Australian drivers and teams was there as well.
Could have been the sports car festival in December.
Yeah.
There's a slogan for they could have used for it.
Now you've got to put the word super in there.
Especially these days. Things start getting interesting for the event, though, early, because when the initial V8 supercar calendar for 2001 is announced, they also announced their final round is on December 2
at Sydney. Let me ask you this. Who did it first? Who announced the date first?
Penrose.
Right.
ALMS.
So it's like 2015 Bathurst 12 hour. All over.
Exactly like it. Similar result. That's in the
damn end, trend here,
too.
Supercars. More than one category can exist in this country.
There is. Exactly. But I mean, Tony Cochran from Red Supercars, he's straight off the bat. He says, why should we have to move our final round of V8 Supercars for what he calls an exhibition match?
Which is really, once again, coming back to just like stupid stuff that is actually causes more harm to Australian motorsport than, do you know what I mean? As you touched on, the ALMS announced the date first. He's saying, why should I move? Well, the question is, why did you schedule it on the same date? And I'm sure you'll get to it in a second, Luke, but it's almost like the die's cast there in terms of what the ultimate move and ulterior motive is from the V8 Supercar Brigade.
Yeah.
They're just so, like, aggressive towards anything.
Unnecessarily. Yeah.
Anything. It's like, you cannot exist.
Exactly, because ALMS is not a competitor.
I think it adds things. So if you got Murphy and Bright, that gets their names out there to the American audience, and they're like, oh, these guys are pretty cool. Let's watch what they race in.
Yep. And he's got form. Sorry. Cochran's got form as well. I think, which it's in the future, but you cross forward to 2006, give or take, when he was having a bit of a blue with the WA government and he wasn't going to fund a street race. So when that got denied, his solution and threat was to tell the WA government that he would purposely schedule a race against the WRC event in Perth so that they would take the Channel 10 TV and that the WRC race wouldn't have any live coverage. So, I mean, like, just shows you the mentality that they had around this time that they were trying to...
I know it's business, but, like...
Oh, it's just...
Come on.
As race fans, though, it's like, you shouldn't have to pick one or the other. Better.
Well, it's interesting. Well, with regard... That was 2001, stoush with the WA government. And the direct quote after basically the WA government says we won't fund a street race, Tony Cochran says in Auto Action, says, seeing they think we're so insignificant, they won't mind us running an event at the same time on the same weekend against their rally next year, and we will have their TV, of course. They think we are insignificant. I'll effing show them who's insignificant.
So once again, so this is like bully boy tactics, putting in jeopardy an Australian event.
You know what, but it worked.
Well, and we'll get to we'll get to that.
Yeah,
we'll get to that. And yeah, no, no, this is the thing. It did have influence. And but I'm like, look at the Australian market now. We have no international sports car race.
Well, we have the 12-hour only because supercars.
Well, were like, so, and there's another stage.
We will own it, yeah, and then you can run it.
As of the moment, we have no WRC. So I'm like, does that might help supercars? Does nothing for Australian motorsport though.
So then there's a bombshell on February 27, 2001, where the South Australian Premier John Olsen reveals that they're no longer going to back the Adelaide American Le Mans Series race.
But so obviously Don Panos has been in the country for 10 days prior to that announcement.
Yep. He'd only just got home.
Boards the plane back home, confident. Obviously he's got a 10-year deal in his back pocket, working towards December 2. And where does Mr. Olsen decide to announce that formal cancellation, Luke?
At a liberal luncheon.
Yes. So you just think, you meet with someone, you do a deal, and then you, in the interim,
yep,
he's done a backflip. And out of all the places to announce this, can I say this without actually talking to Don Panos,
yep,
is that a liberal function?
Yeah.
Let's not get politics into
it. No. Sorry. At a function, a political function. And so you just go, what? How does that work?
Yeah.
Why is that the process to announce a cancellation that there's actually been an agreement for? Yeah. So that struck me as a little bit odd from John Olsen.
Yeah. And his justification for it is he said the choice was Le Mans or 200 nurses. We've taken 200 nurses. And he also says a factor was an overload on the city parklands. I guess the problem is you're never going to win an argument that involves putting the funding towards nurses or hospitals over a car race.
Don was like
taking all the financial risk.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's a good point, because another part of it says that there were rumours it cost the South Australian government $8 million. But it's also mentioned in another place that, yeah, they took all the risk.
Yeah.
The Penos Motor Group.
Yeah, so once again, strange. Like, and like, Jamie could be 100% right, but that's also the race versus nurses argument is also one that you don't want people to argue against. Like, I mean, you use that as a straw argument, so no one's going to...
No one can argue it, because you're never going
to
win it.
But what I'm saying is there doesn't have to be a whole lot of fact behind that as well, because you know you're not going to get quizzed hard on it.
No.
Yeah.
So, I mean the Penos group comes out, you know, off... You know, with the usual stuff you can expect, they come out with saying what the event offered. And, well, amongst other things, Don Penos, we refer back in the previous episode, we talked about how we thought of it all as a family, the American Le Mans series as a family rather than a racing series. And he says that he brought his entire family of 26 out to the race, and that he'd had a draft contract confirming the race for 4 more years. Yeah. So...
And you throw into that as well. So Dean Rainsford, who's obviously Cooper's Brewery, who are an event partner of Don Panels in running the event, he was quoted as saying that he was aware of outside influences that may have prompted the Premier's statement at that political luncheon.
Yeah.
So
we're not doing the clips with 500 if you guys correct run this event.
Yeah. So you kind of move, like, look around and you go, well, you know, you've got a prominent, like Cooper's obviously very proud Adelaide, South Australian company, and citing some external influences. We're looking at the WRC example and that kind of antagonistic and fighting. And you go, oh, I wonder what some of these or who these external influences could be.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to know, because obviously we're all just speculating and these are all just rumours that have filtered through over 20 years or so, but it'd be interesting to know what actually
isn't there a bit of form that, you know, rumours or, you know, information that's come out that it's not the first time for a event at the Adelaide Parklands that a prominent category was pushed off the bill after it was agreed. Yeah. Wasn't it some super touring, was it 99 or Or even 2000.
Yeah, Super Tourers were supposed to be part of the 99 Adelaide 500.
Invited by the government, though. The government wanted them on the bill.
An early plan for it. They were going to be part of it, but they were going to race Saturday. Supercars had raced Sunday.
Yeah. And they got vetoed.
Something got changed. TCR, was it TA2's been in recent times?
Oh, TA2 got up in the end.
Yeah, but wasn't there was some conjecture?
Intellectual property rights over body panels for an American category.
To Brock's point, I agree. Like we're going through all these quotes and different articles around the time, but I think it's fairly obvious that from a V8 supercar or a Vesco point of view, they didn't want two races in Adelaide, and they wanted to be the only show in town. And I guess to close this as well, unrelated, but John Olsen, South Australian Premier at the time, a few years later, wound up working for Vesco.
Yeah.
Was brought on by Tony Cochran. Yeah. So if that may help close the circle and obviously point to the relationship that existed.
In 2001.
Yes.
As South Australian Premier.
Yeah. So, not long after. Yeah. So, an interesting time. And as I said, so sad to see that culminate.
Yeah.
And at least by Don Panos's words here too, all of it while he was out of the country.
Yeah. So. Yeah. To be fair to the Panos group, they got straight down trying to talk the Adelaide government, South Australian government back into it. They got on with trying to find another event.
Mate, that's it. This podcast has put Don Panos really on a pedestal. I don't know him, but based on this, he sounds like a cool guy.
But it's like successful businessmen, they get a big knock back. Yeah. They, as you said, you didn't sit and dwell on it, the Panos group, but they go back and go, I'm going to show you.
It seems
look what
to
I'm
me,
gonna try and do.
Seems to me, this dude is just like, I just want to race in Australia. It's cool.
Yeah. I'm trying to invest tens of millions of dollars and people are standing in my way.
Don't you want my money?
He's let's just have a race. You know, it's...
Yeah, do you not like finance?
Yeah. Super cool. What a legend.
Sandown through the then promoter of the track, John Davison, proposes to host the race in place of Adelaide, but on the proviso it's a December 9 race, a week after the original December 2 date, because that's when they're holding the Clashing V8 Supercar event. But he states that Sandown is willing to host it, but Panos must underwrite the whole event, which I would say he probably would have.
And it would have been a significant less cost than doing the street race, so...
And no disrespect to Sandow, but I don't think that necessarily fit in with the Le Mans vision that we talked about earlier that Don would be going for.
Did it receive good sort of feedback when the Group C cars ran there?
Not really.
No.
No, it wasn't a pop. Not a big crowd. The layout didn't really lend itself to great racing. I know the drivers didn't really particularly like the Sandown Grand Prix track, which I assume is what they would have used, the bit that cuts out Dandenong Road.
When did they get ripped up?
2002.
Oh, right. Okay. Because
they realigned the horse track in 2002. If they started, but they hadn't used the Grand Prix track since probably this Australian Superbikes when they supported V8 Supercar rounds in 98 or 99, it probably hadn't been used since then. That was only being used for bikes because the bikes couldn't go down Dandenong Road.
How do you think the race would have panned out if it went on the current layout that we've got today? It would have just been two straights with the flip-flop over the top. And how do you think the race would have gone down if it did go there?
I don't think it's the sort of track that lends themselves to those sorts of cars.
I think it'd be fine, but I just don't think it played in with the overall, kind of Le Mans take, whereas a city race.
Neither does Adelaide, really. From a track,
but that you think the Formula One and that kind of connection. Yeah.
There's a sort of mystique about street tracks, isn't there? Even if it's a crap race, they're exciting to watch. Okay.
Well, ultimately, a street race is what comes up.
And an interesting one at that, actually. Yeah. Interesting location.
So they did a deal with the New South Wales government to hold a race scheduled for December 8, so a Saturday, 2001, in Homebush on the Olympic precinct. Just a year after the 2000 Olympics.
Perfect timing.
8 years before the V8 supercar race got up on the streets of Homebush.
Again, a good idea.
Yep. So the deal was for a four-hour race with 90 minutes at night. So I would assume, December sunset would be about 8 o'clock.
Yep.
So yeah. Probably you're looking at a 5:30 to 9:30 sort of race.
Mm-hmm.
Would have been amazing. And David Brabham gets quoted again for a new local race, saying Adelaide put on a fantastic event, but Sydney will be a great place to hold the event.
And interestingly, December 8th, not December 2nd.
Yes. Actually, that's a good point.
Pushed it 7 days forward of the supercar.
Working
event.
Solution. Yep.
But as goes with motor racing, it's never... Everyone's looking out for themselves. With the race announced for Homebush, the Australian Racing Drivers Club, who run Eastern Creek, and the Bathurst City Council, who at the time were going for funding on getting the pits and facilities improved at Bathurst, they questioned the funding for the Homebush race straight away, with Bathurst Mayor Ian McIntosh saying, "I would hope it would not be taking money that could have gone to Bathurst." And the ARDC comes out saying it's concerned, but can understand why the New South Wales government would be interested in a race at Homebush. And also, ARDC also said that they were interested in negotiating to hold the Le Mans race at Eastern Creek, which would have been awesome.
Same issue you have, though, with Sandown.
Yeah. But they said if the Le Mans race did go to Homebush, the ARDC wanted to supply services and their experience and everything
to get
something out of it. And it also says the ARDC were vehemently against a V8 supercar race at Homebush.
Why is that?
Well, ultimately, they lost their round.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was used as if we get a Sydney round, we won't go to Eastern Creek anymore.
Which is ultimately what happened
in
2009.
Which is interesting because it's a government-owned site at Eastern Creek that ARDC run on behalf of the government. So... it's interesting on that fact.
Yeah. So everything seems like it's all set to go. The new finale on December 8th. And then all of a sudden, the race gets cancelled. Because...
Hang on. Why did the race get cancelled, Daniel? Have a guess.
I'm going to guess publicly it was announced because of a certain type of... frog
that's
in the area?
Incorrect. Adam, why do you think the race was cancelled?
Outside influences?
Incorrect. It was cancelled because of a frog. Daniel was correct.
But I don't fully believe it was cancelled because of a frog. I think that was I reckon it was a convenient thing that they could announce.
I don't know, man.
But it's
you think they just backed out of the race?
Well, the frog egg didn't just appear in 2001.
But they didn't know they were there. Maybe it was a nest for there, and maybe with all the recent development, that sort of frog had been under threat or something.
So they spotted a green and golden bell frog, which was on Australia's list of vulnerable species.
I'm going to look up that frog and we'll just give a description of what it looks like as well.
And while Brock does that, the frog had forced the redesign of the Olympic precinct in 1993 for the 2000 Olympics. But yeah, no, you think it was...
Well, no, my point is it was there before the Olympic site was built and they were able to turn that thing upside down and put hundreds of thousands of people through there for a day. I don't understand, and nor do I believe that stopped a car race in 2001 when it had the Olympics. So it existed pre all these events. Yeah. And so, I think it was just convenient, again, to prevent... going into the real details.
Because it was rumoured when supercars went there, they had a similar issue that got brought up again about the frog being there, but the race went ahead.
Yeah, the government found a way around it.
Yeah.
So. Well, the frog, for everyone wondering, is it just looks like a normal green frog. and some of them have a bit of gold on them. But, you know, I like frogs.
Yeah.
I like animals.
Yeah.
It's all right.
Well, there's nothing against vulnerable species, but like if it was there, as Daniel said, 93, I think outside influence has come into it.
Mm. So with that, Penoz basically says they think it's a solvable problem, but there's not enough time, and calls an Australian trip off for 2001. And ultimately with that, after 2001, the American Le Mans series doesn't go to Europe anymore. It did two races there in 2001, but after that just sticks to America. And the dream sort of ended after that.
Sad. Can I just throw in one thing, though? It didn't quite have to end.
No.
In 2009, the A1 GP reneged on their deal to race at the Gold Coast Indy after the IndyCars finished. And in a Gold Coast Motorsport document, one of the options put forward was for the ALMS series in 2009 and beyond to be that replacement category that obviously ended up going to the V8 supercars. But one of the category risks identified was that the legacy of an unsuccessful Adelaide event in 2000 was a deciding factor in them not being put forward, which I found interesting because for everything we've discussed today, I don't think that's a representative take on what actually occurred in Adelaide, but the stigma kind of that stuck to it because of all these scenarios has been that it's unsuccessful. So
would that be a loaded thing at the time? Because I think at the reprise of the Gold Coast event around that time, Supercars had an involvement of the rebrand after A1GP.
Yeah,
but so did IMG have something to do with the Gold Coast prior to that?
No, so this document was done by the government, but I think it just showed you the overall feel that was projected from it, which I thought was pretty disappointing to see that in writing.
Yeah,
so
we can all maintain hope because the full field of IMSA cars in Australia
would be
there wherever it is in the country.
Ooh, that'd be the Bathurst 12-hour trip on tour, I think.
Yeah,
I like it.
So if you had to sum up in final summary, just a quick final thought on the event, just.
But going through this has been great and heartbreaking to relive at the same time, but I live by the words, it's better to have loved than lost than to never have loved at all. So I still look back on that race very fondly.
Unique event, only happened once. Great if something to the same caliber could come back to it. But looking back on the race, 20 years this year on it, fantastic event for it there, and I hope something close to it comes back shortly so we can enjoy it.
I think a good concept, sad really
unfulfilled
sad, and god him, so please come back.
I feel for Don Panels too, for putting so much work into it,
and IMSA, please, I want to see those GTLM Porsches, please.
And I'm just glad that the race ultimately wasn't decided by a kilt.
That is a positive, or
a luggage.
So, in final question, did Brad Jones win the race of 1,000 years?
No, he did not.
Okay, well, that's that then, guys.
He was. They were thinking. They tried to get him in for the last 15 minutes of the race, but Audi couldn't get an answer on whether if the car didn't finish, would they still be credited with the win because they were that far in front?
And if you have the option to buy a 2001 or a 2000 Panels, buy the 2000.
Definitely.
Well, that wraps up our look at the 2000 race of 1,000 years. Join us for part 3, where we have a special interview next episode with someone who was at the event. Motor Racing Passion is produced by Luke Ryan for Tum Drum Media.